Welcome to In the Middle. I'm Joey Block. Well, despite all the drama that's happened on Capitol Hill, whether it was getting into fistfights or, you know, news regarding re-election bids, Congress, believe it or not, managed to avert a government shutdown. They managed to get some business done there. The Senate passed a stopgap spending measure ahead of the deadline, which was on Friday. The vote came down 87 to 11 with 10 Republicans and one Democrat, who was Colorado Senator Michael Bennett, voting against the measure. Now, interesting fact here is the drama surrounding the Republicans, right? Well, it's a lot of conservatives who, for the most part, are not happy with this plan, which we'll get to in a moment here. But let's go break down what this legislation actually does. The interesting part is the Democrat not voting for it, which she is from Colorado, which is kind of a purplish state, so maybe there's some political strategy behind that. But anyways, let's get into what this is actually about. The legislation funds four federal agencies until January 19th. Now, what are the four? They include agriculture, transportation, housing and urban development, and Veterans Affairs, while the rest are funded until February 2nd. And the one of them in particular that goes till the 2nd is the Defense Department. They are getting their funding till the 2nd, so they can continue to do what they need to do on their end. Now, in the midst of all this, Congress is supposed to be negotiating a long-term spending bill. Now, if they can't manage to negotiate that across-the-board spending cut of 1% is going to happen across all the agencies in April. So a 1% spending cut all over the government is happening in April if they can't manage to get something together. That's a part of the agreement. You remember, with Mike Johnson being House Speaker, he was trying to shake things up to where, you know, we're not going to tolerate this continuing resolution crap anymore. That's more or less what he and many conservatives have been clamoring for. Now, as I mentioned, the 10 Republicans, they voted against that in the Senate. And the House was no stranger to that either, because the House passed the bill 336 to 95 earlier in the week. But all but two of the no votes were coming from Republicans. So he's got a little problem in his own camp there, Mike Johnson, because the conservatives are a little outraged, especially in the House, about the fact that this bill failed to push for spending cuts initially. Now, there is that 1% cut, but that is not what they're looking for. They want cuts in the spending. They didn't really want this continuing resolution. So they're a little annoyed about that, which is why Johnson has to walk the tightrope here, because he's got to get this all done to obviously fund the government, but at the same time, he has to try and appease the people that got him elected. Because remember, a lot of these hardline conservatives, they wouldn't even vote for Kevin McCarthy. Kevin McCarthy barely got the number he needed when he initially got the Speaker's gavel. But now, Johnson, he got 220 votes. So Johnson got more than anybody else in this caucus has managed to get. So he's the guy. So as the guy, now he has to unify the caucus. And also, interesting to note here, is the thing that got McCarthy ousted from the speakership is the fact that he worked with Democrats. What did Johnson do? He worked with Democrats because an overwhelming amount of them voted for this bill. But there is some victory in this sense, because Johnson is a guy who has been advocating for standalone bills for things. He wants standalone bills. He does not want this omnibus spending bill. It's kind of a term that's been thrown around there. Basically, they shove a whole pile of stuff in there, and it's all a bunch of programs and funding that may not necessarily be related to one another. And then they pass this big bill, and the pass has been around the holiday season, where people aren't paying attention as much. You know, the American public, you're sitting there doing your Christmas shopping. You're out there, you know, putting up the decorations. Maybe you're putting up your menorah if you're celebrating Hanukkah. You know the deal. You're not sitting there thinking about, wow, what's the government doing? What's the latest move? But that's what they're counting on. So a lot of these Republicans were a little annoyed about that, especially under Nancy Pelosi's tenure in the speakership, where she would constantly be passing stuff like this. So Republicans are trying to put an end to that. They weren't able to, yet they kind of did at this point because, you know, you're getting your standalone, but they haven't passed the long-term spending package yet. We're going to have to see if Johnson can do that because right now it's a lot of continuing resolutions, which is basically just continuing the same thing. It's the status quo. The same thing that happened for this fiscal year is happening for the next one. It's kind of just a teetering a back and forth kind of thing. But it's important to note, there is no new funding for Israel, Ukraine, or border security in this bill. So it doesn't have any of that. And that is what the president was asking for, because his compromise was, all right, we're going to do funding for Israel, and we'll even throw some border security funding in there. But you Republicans, you got to vote for this Ukraine thing. We need some more money to your Ukraine. Now, as you know, Republicans are not too thrilled about the idea of Ukraine. They want everything separate. Now, Johnson has come out in favor of support for funding for all these things, but also, Johnson, what he's trying to do here is provide cover for the members who don't want to vote for certain things. You know, everybody's going to want to vote for Israel. Everybody on the Republican side is going to want to vote for the border security. When it comes to that Ukraine funding, that may be a little harder. So Johnson is trying to weave the needle here, maybe to where he can get the Democratic support on the Ukraine funding, and then the overwhelming support on the Israel funding, and then maybe get a compromise on the border security funding. Now, we'll have to see at some point, does the president manage to negotiate the deal with Johnson to where everybody gets everything? Or is this going to be standalone things and certain things are going to happen and certain things are not? That's what we're going to be watching here over these next few weeks. Now, although the holidays are coming in here to full gear, let's go back and look at that date again. Because there's four federal entities that only have funding till January 19th. So that means as soon as New Year's is done, they're going to be hitting the ground running here. Yeah, there's probably going to be some back and forth behind the scenes negotiations happening over the holiday season, but we're really not going to see an actual plan probably the floor until the new year has come. So we're going to be watching that and seeing how this plays into everything that is going on here, because as you know, Congress is, it seems like one thing after the next is happening, and the margins of the majority are so tight in these chambers right now. Democrats only have 51 seats in the Senate, and that's including two independents who caucus with them. And then you have, on the House side, you have the Republicans who have a four-seat majority. And, you know, you got George Santos not running for re-election, so that district is going to be interesting to see how that plays out. And then, of course, you got the Alabama decision where they, in Alabama, have to draw a second black majority district. And that could tend to, traditionally, his favorite Democrats. So that means one less seat there for them. So they're going in this thing with possibly maybe only having two seats if they don't do anything wrong. A two-seat majority, which would probably be one of the tightest in all of U.S. history. And then Senate, you have Joe Manchin. He's not running. He's the Democratic senator from West Virginia, so Republicans are looking to pick that up. That'd bring it to 50-50. Then I got to go somewhere else on the map. And the map is more favorable to them on the Senate side. The House side, it's a different story. So we're going to be looking at all that. But there is some election news that is happening right in this very state. And it's one where maybe it sounds a little bit like someone else who ran for public office. Let's say back in 2016. A Hillary Clinton-like figure. Well, let's talk about her. New Jersey First Lady Tammy Murphy has jumped into the race for Senate. Murphy made it official on Wednesday in a video posted to social media where she touts her credentials in the finance world, working twice as hard as the men, considering that she was the only woman at the table. That's kind of a quote from her video. And her work in maternal health. That's a big initiative that she has done as the First Lady of New Jersey. Now, with her entrance into this race, she could potentially be challenging the sitting senator, Bob Menendez, who has not officially said whether he's going to get into this thing or not. He hasn't said whether he's officially running, but he has hinted at it several times and has always said, that's my plan. That's my plan, my plan, my plan. But of course, you got to file. You have to make the announcement, yada, yada, yada. And right now, his approval rating is currently underwater amid a federal indictment on bribery charges and accusations that he acted as a foreign agent on behalf of the Egyptian government. So he's got some trouble he's got to currently deal with right now. Now, in terms of Murphy, she is currently going up against New Jersey 3rd District Congressman Andy Kim and former Newark School Board member and civil rights activist Lawrence Ham in the primary. And these are just, we could be getting another person or two. But right now, the behind the scenes action is that the establishment's going to kind of rally behind her. And the progressives, for the most part, are rallying behind Andy Kim. A lot of the grassroots organizations have already endorsed Kim. So it could potentially be a two-way race there. We'll have to see if Menendez gets in. Does that make the calculus go a little differently? Well, that's something we're going to have to see because there's been some polling done on this. Now, I want to note this happened before Tammy Murphy got in the race. So this polling is kind of just like she was feeling it out. We kind of heard she was going to announce this week. We heard that she had already established a campaign account and a social media account, but it wasn't official. Just keep that in mind here. But based on the polling that we received from public policy polling, it shows that Andy Kim is the current front runner in this race. He's got the early lead here over Tammy Murphy by 19 points. 19. I'm going to say that again. 19 points, with Menendez just getting 5% support in this poll. Basically, Kim leads Murphy 40% to 21%. But also an interesting statistic here is that 34% of the respondents are undecided. So that still means they got a lot of work to do on both sides here. And, you know, that some people might be surprised at that because of the fact of Governor Murphy. His approval ratings are above water right now. So you think she'd be able to ride his coattails. Now, yes, with establishment donors, that's expected. And there's already a lot of county party officials who have come out in support of Murphy across the state. A lot of these endorsements are, of course, being obtained by her husband, who has the relationships, who's had to go do this back in 2017, back in 2021. He's a guy who's had to go compete for these lines. So he knows the game. He knows how to play it in all 21 counties, especially in South Jersey, where Andy Kim is going to try and make a push there to kind of ward her off. Now, Kim, for his part, with this county organizational line thing, he has come out against it. He says the system needs to go. But right on our show, he said he still plans on competing for those lines. While with Murphy, for the most part, it looks like she's pretty supportive of the lines. Now, important to note, her husband, the governor, has not really said either way. He's kind of been wishy-washy. He hasn't really said what the future of this should be. So we don't know for sure the stance, but we can gather she is embracing this kind of establishment wing within the party. Now, interesting fact here, if elected, she would be New Jersey's first female senator. That has never happened before. New Jersey is just one of 17 states to never have a woman senator. So that would be a historical thing. And potentially we could have what could be the first head-to-head matchup of women, female nominees from both major parties. Because right now the front runner on the Republican side is Christine Serrano Glassner. So if she gets the nomination and Murphy gets it, that would almost guarantee that those two, unless it was some like third party bid or some odd thing like that, but we wouldn't expect at this point, that would pretty much guarantee that those, that one of these women would win and that New Jersey would get its first female senator. So we could be making history here one way or another, whether it's the Republicans pulling up a massive, massive upset in light of this Menendez indictment and what's going on in the country, or it could be on the Murphy side where she would be the first lady of New Jersey to be elected senator. Now, there's only been one, as I alluded to earlier, in all of U.S. history that we have seen something like that, and that is Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton, immediately right after her husband's conclusion of his term for president, actually, she ran in the election. He was still in office that last year, actually. It was the year 2000, so that was when Bush and Gore were running. He was still president, and she went to New York, got a house there, ran for Senate, and won, being the first lady to serve as a senator. So Murphy would have that distinguished honor to be a first lady who is serving. But this would be actually more interesting because she would, in addition to being a senator, she would still be first lady for about a year because Governor Murphy's term doesn't expire until 2026. So if she won in November 2024, she would be serving from January 2025 to January 2026 as both. And, you know, senators, a lot of time they're in Washington, she wouldn't be in the state. So it's a very interesting dynamic that's going to be playing if Murphy does get the nomination and manages to win the seat. A lot to talk about there. And we're going to be seeing how the voters react. Are they into it? Are they not into it? Do they think they need to have someone more experienced in the role? It's hard to say because, again, these two candidates who are running have never run for state office before. Kim, yeah, he's got the experience being a guy who's won a tough race or perceived to be a tough race. But they have never done this type of campaign, either one of them. You know, you got Lawrence Ham, of course, who has run for this office before. He primaried Cory Booker back in 2020. Obviously, he did not win that. Cory Booker won that overwhelmingly. But there's the experience. These people have never done it before. So we're going to have to see how their candidacies work, what the formula is, and who New Jersey Democrats ultimately land on at the end of the day in June. June is going to be a primary because we haven't seen a competitive primary like this in a really long time. And that comes as we could have a potentially very competitive primary the year afterwards for 2025 for the governor's race, where Mikey Sherrill is rumored to be considering a run. You have Steve Fulop in there. Then you have former state Senate President Steve Sweeney, who could also be jumping in the race. And who knows? Maybe there's someone else we don't even know about. Remember, that's how Murphy got in, because Murphy started out in the polls at number 3. No one knew who this guy was, but he had a lot of cash. He poured in about $10 million of his own dollars into the race, and Steve Sweeney, Steve Fulop, they were kind of on the top of the pack there, and then once it was kind of determined that neither one of them were running, then Murphy jumped, and he sealed the deal at that point before the race really got underway. By the time the candidates were set, he had he had everyone paying attention to him. And the rest is history, as now he is a two-term Democratic governor in New Jersey, something that hadn't happened in almost 45 years at that point. But here's what we're getting in the middle of this week. We're keeping on with this election talk here. Republicans underperformed in last week's election, with Democrats now picking up 6 seats in the state assembly. They just got a new one there. They had some mail-in voting come in the 8th district, and now Democrats picked up a seat there for the first time in decades down in the 8th district in South Jersey. So that brings the grand total to 6. So despite these losses at the state level, the GOP did fare better in a number of local races across New Jersey. Republicans even managed to flip a number of Democrat-held mayoral seats. One of those seats lies in a blue town called Somerville. There, Republican challenger and former Somerset County freeholder Brian Gallagher successfully ousted Democratic Mayor Dennis Sullivan. Gallagher beat Sullivan by just over 250 votes, reclaiming his job, which he held for 14 years, from 2004 to 2018. At that point, he left for the Board of Somerset County Freeholders, which is now called County Commissioners, which he won that race, but then lost the seat 2 years later. This comes as Somerville has become increasingly blue. Democrats have repeatedly won the town in the last few presidential cycles by double digits. Joining me now is Somerville Republican Mayor-elect Brian Gallagher. Mayor-elect Gallagher, thanks for coming on and congratulations on your big win.
Now, you know what? Anytime I get to talk about Somerville, I am all in, ready to go.
You flipped a blue town red, taking back your old job. How did you pull it off?
Well, I don't think there was anything pulled off. I think, if you go back in time, first time I ran for mayor was in 2004. I was a councilman for about 2.5 years prior to that. And over the course of 2004 to 2018, I was reelected 3 times. I was a 4-term mayor. And we accomplished a whole lot, and that was accomplished across party lines. It was never about really R versus D. It was about how can we do the best job for Somerville. And I had some very good, like-minded folks on the council at that time. And I think people looked at that this go-round in the election, and they said, you know what? Somerville really turned itself around over the course of those 14 years. Let's give Gallagher another shot at it. And I think that's what happened.
Now, in terms of your strategy to get out the vote, I know you said to you it didn't seem like a big pull-off because you know this town well, you've served it several times, but what was your strategy? Was it door knocking? Was it social media? Was it holding events, going to large-scale events? What was your strategy to turn out that vote in your favor?
The answer is yes. we did a little bit of everything. I'm a firm believer. Somerville is 2.5 square miles. I call it 2.5 square miles of awesome. And so it's very walkable. This is, I think, the 8th or 9th time I've walked and knocked on almost every door in Somerville. And, you know, you get to know people, you get to know houses, you get to know neighborhoods. And so that was a big core part of it, was back to basics. And it was door knocking. We use social media as another component of it, but we also did a lot of direct mail. So it really was more of an old fashioned campaign with a twist of social media involved in it. Sometimes campaigns get lost up in the technology of things. And the reality is there's nothing better than speaking with someone face to face at the door. That's what they want. They can be heard very directly, and that's what we focused on.
Now, there's been a growing debate in your party about vote by mail and early voting. You talked about how you did direct mail, basically sending ad mailers out talking about your campaign. You say you run an old-fashioned campaign, but there's many in your party, including the former president of the United States, Donald Trump, who have said candidates need to be using vote by mail and early voting in order to bank votes in advance of Election Day. Did your campaign employ any of those methods in your turnout model?
Not a whole lot. But I will circle back and I'll say, I think absolutely. Look, you know, vote by mail is here. And I think the Democratic Party is very good at turning out that vote by mail folks. The Republicans, to some degree, we're still fighting against it. And you look at it and you go, it's here. It's here. And we have to work with it and understand how to motivate our base to go out and use the vote by mail as a tool, as opposed to fighting against it constantly. So, I mean, we did some outreach on vote by mail. I mean, what we focused on was motivating the voter to vote. And it wasn't, again, it was a vote for Somerville. You know, it was very interesting. I had folks who participated in my campaign, and they are by no means registered Republicans. In fact, they are hardcore registered Democrats. And you know, they showed up at one of our first functions, and I said, it's wonderful to see you, but why are you here? And they said, we're not voting R, we're not voting D, we're voting S for Somerville. And that had a very defined effect on me, in that that's what people want. They want to know that you're working for the betterment of their community. And that's what I did.
You're talking about working for the betterment and how you had these volunteers who were hardcore Democrats who worked to help you get elected, which is interesting because you were elected, but there were also some Democrats on the down ballot for the borough council who got elected. So that council that you're going to be working with is still majority Democrat. You've said during your time as mayor previously, you had to work across party lines. Do you see yourself being able to work with these Democrats that are on the council now to accomplish the goals you're looking to set out to do?
I don't perceive them as Democrats. I perceive them as my neighbors. And absolutely. And so my 14 years as mayor, I think I had a majority of Republicans for maybe 2 years of it. The rest of it, I was a minority, but that didn't matter. It really didn't matter, because I think people understood that we were working at the table for all of Somerville. We weren't working for R's. We weren't working for D's. We worked for Somerville. And that's been, that's how I've approached everything in my political life. I still consider myself not a politician. I'm a father of five kids who wanted to make a better community for my children. And over since 2004, I think that's been accomplished. And I think the voters in town looked at that, regardless of party, and they said, you know what? He did a good job, you know, a few years back. Let's give him a crack at it again.
You're set to be sworn in less than 2 months from now. What are your top priorities going to be on day one?
Well, there's a lot. You know, you kind of get a little bit different perspective when you step away from it for a while. So one of there's a couple of big things. So when I was mayor, we pushed redevelopment, and that has restarted the economic engine that's downtown Somerville. And that's a great thing. But one of the things you have to do is when you enact these redevelopment plans, they're not static, they're moldable. And as time goes on, you have to begin to change those redevelopment plans and adapt them to today's world. So as different redevelopments come online, you really have to go back and say, okay, are our other redevelopment plans appropriate in today's world? And I think that's probably one of the first jobs that we have to do. We have to take a look at all of our redevelopment plans and our master plan as well, and make sure that they reflect what the borough's needs are today. And I think that's one. Another one is reviewing the borough code and the code office, because there's nothing more frustrating to a homeowner, a resident, or an entrepreneur, a store owner who wants to invest in their property, who wants to come to Somerville, or who wants to expand their business in Somerville. And they're met with a very costly and not a time friendly environment. And I think that needs to be addressed. You know, one of the challenges you have in a downtown atmosphere is making sure that the entrepreneur has the ability to, entrepreneurs like to work quickly. And it's not to say, you know, we push the code to the side, but we have to ensure that our code is capable of handling the speed at which businesses begin today. We're in a very different world than we were 20 years ago. And we need to make sure that our codes are up to that as well. Recreation, you know, we started the economic engine, and you know, when you think recreation, everybody thinks kids, and rightfully so. But we also have an aging population. We have seniors and veterans who, you know, you look at this and you say, well, what's the recreation component for the other age groups and not just kids? So that's something we want to take a look at as well. And obviously you have the quality of life issues, you know, your traffic speed, your condition of our parks and our trails, implementation of technology to make it easier for folks to do their borough work, both the employee and the resident. You know, with today's technology, the resident should be able to do borough business on their time, not the typical, you know, 8 to 4:30 model. You know, technology demands that we create access to government on our residence time. And that's something that we're going to look at as well. And the list goes on. I mean, there's a lot of things that we're going to take a look at.
You brought up building codes and reassessing and reevaluating redevelopment plans, specifically as it relates to downtown Somerville. Residents in Somerville are speaking out about what to do with the site being left behind by the police station when the department moves to a new location on Gaston Avenue. Many of them say they want to build a performing arts center in its place, while some developers would like to build more apartments there. Where do you stand on the issue?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. And I think the residents, we have to listen to the residents. So one of the components in my platform as I ran for mayor, before this actually took place, was a theater / performing arts / cultural center. And, you know, we've given lots of reasons for people to come to downtown Somerville. You know, a theater or a cultural arts center will give people a reason to stay. And I think it's warranted, whether it's in that location or another location. I think it's necessary downtown. And I'll tell you right up front, one of the things we need to do is to partner with our county commissioners. You know, coming from the seat of a county commissioner, freeholder at that time, but a commissioner, you know, you travel this state, and many of the county seats, the county government invests very heavily in the county seat. We're a small county seat, and one of the other things I want to do is to make sure that we partner correctly with our county commissioners so that they are the spur of investment in Somerville. And whether that is recreation, cultural and performing arts, historic, or all of the above, you know, I plan on approaching them and working with them to make sure that the investment in the county seat as a partner is made by them.
Just to clarify, you said you'd want to listen to your residents, and going back to that specific spot with the police station, that you would essentially like to see this performing arts center be there as opposed to more apartments?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. And again, I don't know if it's right there, but we definitely need a performing arts center or theater performing arts cultural center.
Another thing, especially in regards to zoning, that's kind of been a debate within towns across New Jersey is building marijuana dispensaries. The borough council recently approved a marijuana dispensary to be built by Gaston Avenue. Republicans across the state have largely been against approving these dispensaries. In surrounding towns like Bridgewater and Manville, the local governments have banned weed sales within its municipalities. Do you plan to try and reverse this decision once you've taken office?
No, it's the law in New Jersey. Am I a fan of it? No, but it is the law in New Jersey. And I will say that I think it was zoned in a manner such that it eliminated it from being in the downtown corridor, and it put it on the highway in the highway areas, which is, if you're going to have it, I think that's an appropriate location.
Now, the borough council is looking to approve another dispensary. Do you think that there should be more approved in the future, or should it just be this one and that's it?
I believe there are, if I recall correctly, they enabled two licenses as a maximum to be approved. I would not consider bringing any more on than what's on the books now.
I want to speak more broadly to your party here. As you know, Republicans across the state largely did not fare as well, although they did pick up some wins, obviously, in your town with your election. There are mayoral seats they won in Westfield and Sayreville, as well as certain parts of Somerset County. Besides from that, your party failed to pick up any major wins in the state legislature. What does the GOP need to do in order to turn this around going forward?
Statewide, get on the bandwagon and vote by mail. Very simply. That's it. I think the more call to action, but I look at it and, you know, I've never run as a Republican. I've always run as a person with good ideas who wants to make a community better. And I think if more people on both sides of the aisle had that approach, I think we'd be seeing a much better place. You know, we've got a whole lot of challenges, both at the local, state, and federal level, and a lot of it's due to R versus D and D versus R. And, you know, if everybody took a step back and said, you know, your idea is not always bad and my idea is not always the best, but if we can work together, maybe we can figure out how to make it appropriate and good for all of our residents. I mean, that's really it. It's kind of simple.
I want to hone in on Somerset County, specifically since you've run countywide as a freeholder, which is now called a county commissioner. Republicans have been struggling to gain seats for county commissioner the last few cycles. You lost in 2020. Looking back at that loss and where you are now, set to become mayor once again, how can Republicans be more competitive, specifically in Somerset County? Because they pulled off some wins in certain parts. You had Bridgewater, they did well. They did well in Branchburg, Manville. How do they put the map together to where they can win countywide and deliver more seats and more balance for the county commissioner board?
I think it's all about it's messaging. And look, my previous career, I was in advertising. And, you know, if you can speak to people, if you can explain to them what your message is, they listen. People are very intuitive. They're very sharp. They're very perceptive. And if you can explain to them what your positions are and why, they'll give you a shot. You know, I've proven that. You know, it's Somerville was not, you know, I've been in Somerville now since 1991. And I don't know that it's ever really been a Republican town. It's always leaned a little bit left. But, you know, I give people credit because they listened and they understood what I was trying to say. And I think if the county does the same thing and gets away from the R versus D, I think they'd be in a much better spot.
I want to turn to the party more broadly nationally. The Republican presidential race for the 2024 nomination is set to get underway in just about 2 months. The field is starting to shrink with South Carolina Senator Tim Scott announcing he's dropping out earlier this week. There's a number of candidates running on the Republican side, including our own former governor, Chris Christie. Who would you like to see take on President Biden next year?
I have no idea. I think the reality is, you know, my focus is on Somerville. And for me to, you know, prognosticate or predict, you know, who I would like to see, what I will tell you is I think both parties need to come up with candidates in the future, the near future and the long future, that reflect what the American public is yearning for. And that's common sense. That's it.
You talk about common sense. People really shouldn't be putting a D or an R next to it. The reality is in your party, former President Trump is the current front runner for that nomination. And as you know, he's kind of a guy who's very in on the conservative movement, and he's a bit of a firebrand to some of those. Some people are not as comfortable with the personality, and some people love his policy. He's a very polarizing figure. If he wins the primary, would you support him for president in 2024?
Too early to tell.
Just to clarify more specifically here, there's this debate going on among politicians in the state, across the state, how much that the GOP should embrace Trump. You're someone who has said, you know, people really shouldn't be talking about party as much. They should be talking more about problems. Should Republicans be tying themselves with Trump, or should they try to move away from him?
Yeah, you know what? Again, I'm gonna jump back to my focus is on Somerville. You know, the presidential election is years off, and you know, I just said this to somebody this morning. If everybody takes care of their little piece of the world, we'd be in a much better place, regardless of what your party is. So, you know, I'm not going to go out on a limb and support or you know, not support something that may or may not happen in 2 years. It's just entirely too early to tell and to prognosticate. It just doesn't make sense to do that. You know, it's I understand from a reporter standpoint why you want to do that, but you know, it's not my focus. It's not my focus right now.
Now, I know you don't want to talk about elections that are in the future, but I have to ask you, because this is kind of a Somerset County related issue. The race for governor in 2025 is already picking up steam. Jersey City Mayor Steve Fulop has thrown his hat into the ring on the Democratic side. Former Assemblyman Jack Cittarelli, who has served as a Somerset County freeholder and also an assemblyman, and radio talk show host Bill Spadia have been floated as possible candidates for your party.
Yes.
And State Senator John Bramnick has also been rumored to be considering a bid. Who would you like to see be the nominee for the Republicans in next cycle?
Obviously, you know, the hometown favorite is Jack. And I know Jack. He's done wonderful things when he was in Raritan. He did good things for Raritan. When he was a freeholder, he did great things. And as an assemblyman, you know, he worked hard, and he worked hard for this area. You know, I do support Jack, and I've supported him, you know, for a long time. And were he to throw his hat in the ring, I would support him.
All right. Well, we'll have to see how all these races play out. Somerville Republican Mayor-elect Brian Gallagher, thank you so much for joining me. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well. Some great questions. And, you know, it's I would encourage anybody who has the opportunity, come visit Somerville. It's our 2.5 square miles of awesome.
Well, that about does it for me this week. Thank you so much for joining me as always. To stay in touch with what's going on the show, all you have to do is follow me on social media, which you can do on X, formerly known as Twitter, at @Block_Joey. Again, my last name is spelled BLOCH_Joey. You can also check me out on Instagram at joey.block.39. Again, that is at joey.block.39. Now, you may be listening to the show, you like it, you enjoy the content, but then you're like, where do I find it? Well, here's what you got to do. You got to go to that browser of yours, any internet browser will do. Microsoft Edge, Firefox, Google Chrome, whatever floats your boat there. Well, Internet Explorer may not work anymore. Yeah, that might be a problem. It doesn't really exist anymore. But other than that, any browser will work. So get the browser, go to foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. Again, that is foxsportsradionewjersey.com/podcast. You're going to go there. Then you're going to scroll down until you find In the Middle with Joey Block. You're going to click on that. And all the episodes will be there, with the newest one at the top and the older ones at the bottom. We typically put out new episodes every Friday afternoon at 3 p.m. And before we go, I'd just like to extend my well wishes to you and your family as we go into this holiday season. I want to say a very happy Thanksgiving from my family to yours, from everyone here at Fox Sports New Jersey, and to all of you who are listening out there in the internet sphere, and Central Jersey, and North Jersey, and South Jersey, all of New Jersey, and beyond. Anyone who finds this podcast, we want to wish you the best Thanksgiving. Enjoy the time with family and friends. If you're doing a Friendsgiving, maybe you're going to someone's house for Thanksgiving who's a friend. enjoy the day and be thankful for what you got, because, you know, people don't always think about that. Sometimes life just goes on a flash. And remember the meaning of this holiday, where the pilgrims got on that Mayflower to discover and to fight for a little dream called America, even though they didn't quite know it yet. They were the first settlers before, you know, you had the Jamestown settlement, and then you had them, the pilgrims, on Plymouth Rock, where they were originally trying to go to Jamestown, and then their boat went the wrong way, and they managed to get through that. They persevered, and they managed to work with the Native Americans in order to get through a tough winter. So we give thanks to everything we have here in this country, and we try to find peace with one another here as we go into this holiday season, where there's a lot of joy and cheer to be extended. And, of course, a lot of politics to come here, a lot of big politics news. We're going to be following all that as we close out this year and go into the next year. Well, thank you so much for joining me. It has been a pleasure. We're back in next week with more In the Middle right here on Fox Sports New Jersey.